As AI continues to revolutionize our world, there's a critical conversation we can't ignore: AI safety and security. And that's where HackerOne's AI red teaming comes into play, rigorously testing AI models to prevent them from being misled or exploited. HackerOne employs over 2 million ethical hackers, and 750 of them specialize in prompt hacking and other AI security and testing. So HackerOne isn't just theorizing, they're actively safeguarding AI's future. Just recently, a team unearthed over 100 vulnerabilities in just 2 weeks. So whether you're at the helm of a startup or steering product innovation at a large company, it's time to prioritize AI security. Visit HackerOne.com/AI for more. Again, HackerOne.com/AI.
This episode is brought to you by Gigantic. At Gigantic, you can level up your product skills through live, small group, cohort-based trainings. We're incredibly excited to welcome you to our next cohort of our product strategy training, kicking off in January of 2024. This course will take you through the frameworks that product leaders use at companies like eBay, DoorDash, Groupon, Rent the Runway in order to scale their teams. It's taught by Ben Foster, a friend of this podcast, who is the former chief product officer at Whoop. So come join us. Go to gigantic.is. That's gigantic.is. And save your seat for our January cohort. Your potential is gigantic, and we're here to help you reach it. Go to gigantic.is to reserve your seat today. So I'm not even sure if I need an intro for our interview today. I'm going to talk with Bob Moesta, one of the authors of the Jobs to be Done framework. If you're not familiar with the Jobs to be Done framework, go back and listen to Wednesday's full episode where we break down two of the really iconic Jobs to be Done stories, including one from Bob Moesta, which he's going to talk a bit more about today. So Bob has helped launch over 3,500 products. He interned early on with Dr. Deming, who's the founder of Lean Manufacturing, and he actually helped to set up Lean Manufacturing for Ford here in the States. That was earlier on in his career, and since then, as I mentioned, he's now helped launch over 3,500 products. This is a amazing conversation about jobs to be done, finding out the job of your product, and a couple techniques you can use starting tomorrow or today, how to determine what job your product does and how to clearly communicate that to your clients, taking their anxieties and pain points into account. So stay tuned, we're going to get right into it. Welcome to Rocketship.fm. Where we explore startups from funding to growth, from culture to sales, and everything in between. I'm Michael Sacca.
And I'm Joelle Goldman.
All right, so welcome to the show, Bob. Really excited to have you here today.
Very excited to be here as well. Yeah. This is my life work in terms of the stuff I do, and I'm happy to share.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad. Give me kind of an overview of how you got into product. Just kind of your background.
Yeah. So I started actually as a chemical engineer, but ended up being an electrical engineer. But I really got into product when I actually had a summer internship with a guy by the name of W. Edward Deming, Dr. Deming. And I was his intern for 2 summers, and he was the father of lean and lean manufacturing. And so he took me to Japan, and Ford actually hired me to follow him around and basically learn the methods and build a system to help Ford suppliers. And so as an intern, I was just trying to understand and build case studies and do applications and things like that. But and I got into the manufacturing side of things, and eventually I ended up getting into, well, how do we design things to be manufactured? And so ultimately I kind of moved up the stream into how do we develop new products. And so for Ford, I worked here in the US, and I worked in Germany, and have been basically developing and designing products ever since. I would say I've always been as a little kid, I grew up in Detroit, and we had this thing called Big Junk Day, and people would put all that stuff out, and I would actually go collect stuff and build products. I built speakers and I'd repair TVs. And so I've always been kind of fixing and tinkering and kind of that kind of thing. So I'm very mechanical, you know, in nature. And so to date, I've helped develop and launch over 3,500 products, everything from services and consumer packaged goods, consumer electronics, weapon systems. I worked on engines and rockets for NASA and Department of Defense. So just about anything I can get my hands on, I'll jump into.
It's incredible. So, and one of the frameworks that you use is Jobs to be Done. Tell me, like, for those that aren't familiar, what is Jobs to be Done and why would you use it?
So the thing is when I very early on when I was developing product as an engineer, you'd try to listen to what consumers had to say, and you realize that like when you make what they want, they'd always come back and say, no, that's not what I want now. And it just turned out that I felt like they were lying to me or lying to themselves. And so as much as we do research and surveys, I couldn't figure out kind of what they really meant. And I had enough failures early on where it was kind of like, you know, you said you wanted this, but, you know, it's like, well, I didn't know this other thing existed. So I spent a lot of time trying to figure out kind of how do we actually see what's next. So what I did is I started to look at kind of what I call the vector of progress. And so Jobs to be Done is about people don't buy products, they hire them, which means they also fire other products. And so there's these hiring and firing criteria that are wrapped around the situational context they're in. And that context has kind of here's what's going on and here's what I don't like or here's the problem. And then there's some outcome that they seek. And so it's using that frame around that outcome and the context and the outcome that helps us determine kind of the vector of progress that people are trying to make. And so the job is really kind of how we make progress in our lives daily or as individuals, as teams, as companies, as countries. And so part of this is being able to understand and see these combinations of things. And so it's not just the outcome, but it's the starting place they come from, and it's helping them make that transformation from you know the current state to the new state.
Yeah, interesting. And one of the early projects that you worked on was selling condos in Detroit, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, that was actually that was about 10 years ago. Right before that I was running a private equity firm, and I was traveling a lot. And so every startup I've done, I end up traveling too much. And so when my wife and I just had the conversation and said, well, how do we find something here locally you can do where you can apply everything you know, but you don't have to travel? Because I have four children, and it was just, how do we do that? So I took all these principles and I applied them into kind of the home building and condo business. And so I went in with the intent of kind of, let me learn the business. I'll take a year or two, learn the business, and then I'll start, I'll start investing back into the business. And I end up loving the business. And it turns out that as a builder, there were just so many underlying assumptions you had that people just wanted to buy the house. And it was anybody who was looking at your house never looked at used houses. And there's just all the principles that Clay has in terms of disruption that were playing out. And it was literally on a day-to-day basis. And so We just ended up doing interviews around basically why people bought our houses. And so it's what was the causal factors that end up getting them to our houses. And we just found so many interesting things that helped us kind of change the business and really reframe the business is that, you know, the job that we really help people do is move from one place to another. And it's almost like, I think we had the phrase, move on, move up, building a better life. And it was helping people. Moving always meant that it was another, like they were looking forward to the next thing. So whether it was getting married, whether it was my kids going to school and I needed to, you know, we needed to pick a new school district, whether it was, you know, we're getting divorced and it's like the marriage is over. Okay. But moving on was still like, okay, we have to let go. So what's the housing? What's the living situation? It's going from the big house down to the downside, you know, a downsized type house. And so really focusing on kind of those kinds of things and learning the words that they used helped us do so many different things. It's awesome. I missed it. I think the hardest part was in 2007, December, basically The model that we had is we were building specs to a certain point, which is a home that's like half finished, if you will. And in November of 2007, they stopped doing mortgages for almost 6 months in Michigan, which basically put everybody out of business. So I ended up getting out of the business. I ended up actually working for the banks and helping banks do some things. And then Clay had me come work with him on a couple of projects. And so I started the company I have now. But I still work in the building business. I have lots of friends in the building business. And there's nothing better than giving a family a new set of keys and watching that, you know, stopping by as they move in and move into their new house. It's just it's fabulous.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I love about that story was like personas are something that we're very familiar with in marketing.
Yep.
But
yep.
Then what actually made a difference was recognizing some of the anxieties and circumstances around
right.
their situation. Can you talk to me a bit about how, you know, how to use anxieties and circumstances?
Yeah. So there's two examples I can think of off the top of my head. One was, so we would build these timelines. So the method is really based on interrogation. And so it's both criminal and intelligence interrogation technique more than it is interview and research.
Okay.
And so we're trying to actually build the timeline of why, you know, what caused people to get to this house. And so you figure out when they bought, but you back it all the way up. And one of the things that we found, for example, in the downsizing side is almost, you know, something like 83-84% of the people had the first thought of, boy, it's time to move between Thanksgiving and New Year's. And it, like, we didn't know this. It was like, well, so when did you really say, God, you know, we should really think about moving or when did you really have the thought? And almost everybody talked about it being at that time of the year. And when you start to unpack it, it makes a lot of sense. It's like the house is too big. The neighborhood is changing. We got to figure out what we're going to do. And it turns out that not only did downsizers do it, but just about everybody else did it too. And as a builder, we actually changed all of our, we actually stopped marketing in November because nobody bought a home.
Right.
And so we started to change some of those things. We actually put some different kinds of ads during the during the holidays. Like, you know, as you think of where you're going to be next year, think of us kind of stuff.
Right.
And so the other thing we found, though, is like the people would go, the downsizers would say, like, yeah, you know, we thought about it. And then we got a realtor in February. And we're like, okay, so, you know, why February? And they'd be like, I don't know. It was a good friend of ours. And they talk all about the realtor that they picked up. And
okay.
And it'd be like, yeah, but why February? And all of a sudden we heard this story about the couple sitting around the breakfast table looking at the paper and actually turning through the obituaries, and they found out that one of their friends had passed away, and they had this conversation that was pretty much like, you know, hey, Jim just died and Sally is now left to move the house by herself, and we don't want that to happen. We need to get on this because I don't want you to die. You don't want me to die. We should do this together. And so it turns out that these people went from what we call passive looking to active looking at this conversation. We heard it once, twice. I heard about seven or eight times. I'm like, what's up with that? And so what we did is we put some advertising in the obituaries around, like, time to move, need some help, give us a call. Nothing more than that.
Right.
37% increase in my traffic, 70% reduction in my advertising costs.
Holy cow. That's amazing.
So people would say, well, boy, that's really pulling on people's heartstrings. Like, but the reality is this, is they're trying to make progress. They want to do something. And when we were able to actually find that time and space where they were at, we were able to figure out a way in which to do it.
Yeah.
So I have lots of these examples, but that's a really good one from a kind of a marketing perspective of just realizing that when you understand that time and space, you can take advantage of it. And when you get it, you don't have to be so broad. You can actually be really focused to generate what's the next step for them. So it wasn't showing them a condo. It was literally empathizing with their situation and getting them to call us to say, let us help you kind of frame up how you're going to move.
Right. I mean, because it's right. a problem that they have. It's not
– exactly.
You know, death is a part of life.
It's their problem.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And what we were trying to do is make sure that most people are trying to sell a specific solution. And the reality is we have to realize that the real solution is created by our customers. And products are only a small part of the solution. They're never the whole solution. And so we have to frame it in the way of what, like, the, we got to help them make progress as opposed to just buy our product.
So we're going to get right back to our interview with Bob. In fact, we're going to talk about finding causation in customer interviews. That'll be right after a word from our sponsor. This product series is also brought to you by ChargeBee.
So whether you're the CEO and want to make your developer a hero, or you're a developer and want to be a hero, go to chargebee.com/rocketship to find out more about how ChargeBee is the smartest way to set up your subscription billing.
So don't build this all yourself. Be a hero, get it done right, and move on to building the rest of your product. So go to chargebee.com/rocketship and get started for free. Now back to our interview with Bob Moesta. Right, right. So how do you find that causation? How do you find the reason in that example, you know, that little story in that interview, in that timeline interview?
So the interesting part is, so when I was in Japan, they always talked about what they call technology agnostic or technology independent way to look at something without seeing the solution in it. And I could never really understand it till about 5 or 6 years later. But the notion here is this, is that if I can understand what caused you to buy my condo, so I would actually, I only interview people who have already made the progress. So somebody who, I don't want to buy, interview somebody who wants to buy a house. I actually interview people who have already bought the house, because in that process of doing so, they actually have all these forces that push them and pull them, but they also had anxieties along the way. They also had habits that they had to overcome. And what happens is when they're in the midst of it, they actually don't, none of those are as explicit, or they're, if you will, in the subconscious. But afterwards, you can actually pull them back and say, like, yeah, this and this happened. And I'm like, well, why would you do that? And you just dig and you dig and you start to realize, like, well, I was really worried about something. And so the way we end up doing it in the simple way is we try to take people who have made the progress or tried to make progress and couldn't do it. And we literally build a timeline from when was the first thought you should do something different to what did you try to how did you succeed? And in doing that, we're trying to not understand what they liked about the product, but what actions they took, what anxieties they had, what aspirations they sought, and what drove them to actually make this purchase or this effort. And from that is where how you find the causality. And what it is you end up having to piece together like the dominoes that had to fall in order for them to end up with this product or your product in their, you know, in their hands. And the thing that Deming always talks about is, like, you know, nothing is random. Everything is caused. We just actually we talk about random because the fact is that it means we can't explain it. Right. But if I actually understand that there is no such thing as a random purchase, that means then I have to actually start to understand the underlying causes that done it. And so when I do a set of interviews, I can find a whole different set of causes. And so when I get 10 interviews and put them together, I start to see patterns in causes. This happened, this happened, this happened, and then they bought. Like, wow, that happened with 5 people. What's up with that? And so that's where you start to see the patterns of causality that then allow you to say, what new technology or what other things can I do, or where's the next set of problems going to happen that I can actually innovate in? So for me, again, most of my work is actually on the execution side of innovation, but for me, I can't actually start anywhere else but here. If I can't find a job opening, a place where somebody's dissatisfied, a place where they're trying to make progress and they can't, or a new vector of progress, I don't know how to develop a product anymore. So jobs is like the first of all the different things we do before we launch a new product.
Okay. And then once you find the problem, you work, you already have kind of the marketing laid out, right? And then,
well, but I think you got to think about what's the channel, what are the different venues, how do you actually, I mean, there's a whole bunch of details you have to be able to do, but it stops is all this opinions back and forth of, well, I think it's that, or you'll say it has to. So one of my favorite is if you'll do like traditional kind of research, people say, God, they just want it easy. And so from a marketing perspective, they know that if it's easy and simple, people will use it. And it's like, okay, great. But as an engineer, I have to cause easy. And so when I start to unpack the word easy, does it mean easy to buy? Does it mean easy to set up? Does it easy to dispose? It's easy to learn. It's easy to use. It's easy to share. What does easy mean? And what you find is there's 20 definitions of easy that I have to put together to cause it. And so if I can't understand those things, the marketing job is done usually to get the communication. But as the engineer, my job isn't done until I actually satisfy. So that's what we're trying to make sure that we connect with, is not only just the language, but what they mean by the language. So if it's really about they want it easy and simple, it's like, why do they want it easy and simple? Well, they want it easy and simple because they can do it without looking. So for example, if you remember a BlackBerry had a keyboard. The number one complaint everybody has about new phones is in the old BlackBerry, you could tactily type. I could run my fingers across the keyboard and know how to type with never looking at it. And there were many people who did that. And so that was, again, one of those subtle things that people said, well, yeah, God, I don't want to get rid of my BlackBerry because I won't be able to type. And nobody could understand what they meant until you started to say, well, what do you mean? And you watch them type without looking.
Yeah, you definitely. Okay.
So those are the things you're looking for.
So how when you're setting up these interviews, how do you set them up in a way that doesn't cause like bias and
yep.
You know, so you're getting the right information out of them.
Yep. Yeah. So again, because the premise is that it's one, it's in the past. Two is I'm not worried about what they bought, but the progress they were seeking to make when they bought that product. I'm actually just trying to get the truth. And okay. So when you start to listen to some of the interviews, we have a podcast called Jobs to Be Done Radio, and we've got some interviews up on that. But what you realize is we start to actually when we never talk to people who want to do something. We talk to people who have actually tried and either failed or made it, but they're past the decision point. They've made some kind of commitment to do something. Because if I interview people who just want to buy a house and they're like, I'm in the market and I'm looking, what happens is you get, I want 5 bedrooms, I want 3.5 baths, I want granite countertops, I want, because there's no money involved.
Right.
But the reality is when they purchase, there is no purchase that is ideal. Every purchase has a trade-off in it. And ultimately, I'm trying to use trade-offs to understand the hierarchy of what's important to them. So a very good friend of mine bought a brand new R7 Audi. It's an $80,000 car. Absolutely gorgeous. Drives up. I'm like, wow, this thing is beautiful. He goes, yeah, it's great. It's gray. I'm like, and this is his face. I'm like, what? He goes like, well, you know, I wanted white. I'm like, but you just bought an $80,000 car and it's not the color you want? He goes, yeah, I had to wait 2 more weeks. I was like, well, it couldn't have been that important then. Like at some point, it's like if you could have waited 2 weeks, you can rent a car for that. I mean, there's a whole bunch of – and it's one of those things where it's like you start to realize like we make trade-offs. And as much as it says, God, I really want white, and I would say white all the time, the reality is he wanted the car and he wanted to have – there's a whole bunch of other things that were at play. And despite the fact of what he said he wanted, he was willing to trade off. And so part of it is the value code of how people are – how these things are helping them make progress. That value code is embedded in all the trade-offs they make. So the interviews to me are all about helping people get to kind of those trade-offs and understand the trade-offs they're willing to make. So I literally don't ever want to talk to people who want to do something. I've only talked to – I talk to doers, not – wannabes.
Sure. Yeah. And you're trying to find more of them. And I think that makes a lot of sense.
And so if anything, that's the hardest part. So for example, in software, what we'll do is I want five people who have recently signed up in the last 90 days. Like I don't want them like in a week, last week. I want them to have some time with it and play with it, but they had to do it, let's say, in the last 90 to 180 days. Mm-hmm. So it's like, what caused you to sign up for this? What else did you look at? Why did you look at this? Okay, what was your expectation when you signed up? All right, how are you using it? Does it living up those expectations? Like all that story, helps us be able to see that. The other is I would take 5 people who have left my product. So from a software perspective, it's like, they just canceled the subscription and they were pretty heavy users or users that have used it in a way as opposed to people just dabbling in it. Mm-hmm. And you say like, this is not about getting you back, but tell me the journey of how you decided to go somewhere else. Where did you go? Why did you go? And the best part is if you ask them up front, they'll say a bunch of kind of excuses. And they almost never match to the real reasons why they actually left. So a survey at the end, an exit interview survey, to say, why are people, God, it's too expensive. What you'll find is like, yeah, it didn't have the features, or there was way too many features that it had that I couldn't actually figure out. It was too complicated. So it was, you know, it was just, I needed something simpler. So, you know, it's just too expensive. Like their logic of how they answer the question is just so convoluted, but it gets down to it's not what they usually say.
Interesting. When you're entering a new market, habit is one of the biggest things that you have to overcome.
Yeah.
How do you approach when you're up against like a fixed habit?
Yeah. So I think the habit is one of those forces you really have to like, in a lot of cases, the habit, when it's so strong, you can't even get into the consideration set. They don't even know there's a problem. They think it's themselves that's causing the problem, as opposed to like the lawnmower, for example. The you know, it won't start. They can't pull it. They think it, people will sit there and go, yeah, I didn't get the right. Oh, that gas is kind of old, and like all of a sudden it's like, you know, they have all these other things wrapped around it that they blame themselves around it. They actually never think like, well, maybe I need a new lawnmower.
Interesting. Yeah.
Right. You know, this book I have that I've been working with Clay on, that comes out in October. We have a mattress interview, and this guy goes in and he says, yeah, I did a total impulse purchase on a mattress from Costco. And he talks about the whole thing and tells me about how he bought it and everything else. And then you go like, well, how long have you been not sleeping well? He goes, 2 years. And he starts to talk about all these different things in his life that he did to try to compensate, until he finally came to the conclusion that it was the mattress, which is the habit. And so part of it is being able to understand kind of the ahas that people come to realize that the habit is the problem and not them. And so studying the habit is really, really important.
And is that something that you can speak to in the marketing or in the product? Like, how do you address it?
For sure. It's like, so this guy, he drank scotch. He worked out really hard, and he tried to stay up late so he could sleep more. Okay. So my thing is it really you, or is it your mattress? In the advertising, you could frame it up so easily to say like, oh my God, I do that and that. Maybe it is my mattress. So you can actually start to make them aware of it. And it's and because I always think of people are the real innovators, and what we want to do is understand the innovations that I always think of everybody's early adopters. And so the moments that they make these choices, there's hundreds of thousands of people behind them going like, I got to go work out more. My back hurts. It's like, right. No, it's a mattress, dude. You know?
Okay. Yeah, I love it.
Do you know what I mean? Like it's the funniest part is like when people get the new mattress, it's kind of like, wow, like almost the average time between when people, first of all, don't even know how to buy a mattress.
Right.
They don't know what to look for in a mattress. They have no idea about the quality characteristics of a mattress, and they want to get it over as fast as possible. And they're still never sure whether their old mattress is bad or not. Right. Huge opportunities.
And yet it's something you use every single day.
Every single day. Yeah. Like in my field, like, I don't want to go to the mattress store. Everybody else is laying down on that stuff. Like, okay, how are we supposed to buy a mattress? You know, we'll order it from Amazon and we'll just ship it back. Okay. And you'll be surprised how many mattresses Amazon sells. You would be just surprised.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Okay. Well, man.
So the key to the story though is that struggling moments are the seed for all innovation. The more we can find these struggling moments where people struggle, and especially where they blame themselves. God, you know, I'm just out of shape. I got to go work out. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like my back hurts. You know, I it's just the stress. I'm working too hard. Like, but the moment they're struggling, the fact is they never look to the product side. And so my thing is trying to find those struggling moments where people want to make progress, but they can't. That's where innovation needs to be.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the perfect place to leave it here. Yeah. I mean, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. Where can we keep up with you? Jobs to be Done podcast, everything.
So we have jobstobedone.org is kind of a collective place where we pull everything around Jobs to be Done together. So anybody who writes anything or publishes anything, we try to put it all in one place. We have something called Jobs to be Done Radio on iTunes. So it's a 30 or so podcast. It's one of those things we've We haven't done a new one in a while, but there's a really good depth of interviews with people like Jason Fried and Ryan Singer and just different people from all over who are jobs, you know, people who have been doing jobs for a while, and then we have interviews and stuff like that. And then you can just follow me at bmoesta, B-M-O-E-S-T-A. On Twitter, and you know, that's the best place to get a hold of me.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Michael.
I really hope you're enjoying this product series so far. We still have a little ways to go. There's like 8 more episodes all on product. 4 interviews, 4 full episodes. On Wednesday, we're doing an interview on using data to inform your customer decisions, so you don't want to miss that. We're going to hear back from Ben Foster and hear a bit about his time at eBay. So that'll be incredibly insightful. Big thanks to our sponsors, Team Gantt. Go to teamgantt.com/rocketship and use the code SAVEONTG to get 50% off your first 6 months. And by BrandBucket, go to brandbucket.com/rocketship. You get a special offer. Plus, you can get your next company name, logo, and domain all in one spot, just like Mattermark. You really can't lose there. And by ChargeBee. ChargeBee is the easiest way to set up your subscription billing. Go to chargebee.com/rocketship and get set up for free. So follow us on Twitter at RocketshipFM. You can follow me at Michael Sacca, Joelle at Joelle Goldman, and we'll see you back here in just a couple days. And psst, if you're still listening, shoot us an email, team@rocketshipfm, or tweet us at rocketshipfm. And I want to get a pack of stickers into your hands, absolutely free. All you got to do is let us know that you're listening, and I will send them right to your door. So that's team@rocketshipfm or @rocketshipfm on Twitter.